2003, and colleagues, our order on the agenda today is going to be hearing first Senate Bill 552 and the companion SCR 19, and then we will have a public hearing on House Bill 3000, and there are amendments at your desk that relate to that bill. And the work session scheduled for 3611 and HCR 54, we will postpone that work session until tomorrow when Representative Forrest returns. So with that, let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 552, and we could probably do a joint public hearing as well on SJR 19, and invite Senator Metzger forward.
Thank you, Chairman Doyle, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I present before you Senate Joint Resolution 19 and the companion implementing legislation, which is Senate Bill 552. And these were worked on in the Senate and addresses a problem that we have with our election process since we moved to the vote-by-mail system of election. Fortunately, it has not reared itself because we haven't had faced with a death of a candidate, but I wanted to just briefly tell you the problem that we have with our system and what SJR 19 and Senate Bill 552 intend to correct. Under current law, if a candidate dies who is standing for election in a partisan office prior to the election date, the party of which that the deceased is a member is entitled then to replace that candidate on the ballot. And this worked fine, and although fortunately it does not have to happen very often. The last major time this happened in Oregon was 50 years ago in the gubernatorial race in the late 1950s. But what would happen in that situation would be if someone, say, in October were to die who was standing for state office, then that party would replace that candidate on the ballot. The election would go forward, and county clerks simply in their offices on the regular voting machine would replace the name with of Representative Verger with whoever else was the party had named their candidate. And so when election day came and you came into the polling booth, you were voting for whoever the party's candidate actually was. The problem with now with our vote-by-mail system, you can no longer do that because our elections now are almost 3 weeks long. And if someone dies during this vote-by-mail window, the party by law is allowed to replace that candidate, but there is no provision to return the ballots of everyone who has voted up to that point who has voted for anybody except for your replacement candidate. Ted Rutlinger from Legislative Council is here, is also could give you additional information, but I'll give you an example of how that would work. Under our current law, just as a hypothetical in our most recent election, say for governor, let's say 10 days before the election of governor, Mr. Mannix were to die in a plane crash as he was circling Oregon. Well, under the law, the party, in this case the Republican Party, would have a right to replace him. They could put a Mr. Saxton up or Mr. Roberts. The problem was at that point 422,000 Oregonians had voted, and not one had voted for either of those individuals, and making it virtually impossible for that individual to win the election. So, if the election were to go forward and the deceased person, in our example, Mr. Mannix, were to win, the party is not allowed to replace him. That's not how the law works. And the law works for, in case of governor, would be that if the incumbent governor was not defeated at election, in this case, John Kitzhaber was the incumbent governor and did not stand for election, therefore was not defeated at election, he would remain on as governor for the next 2 years. So, therefore, the party would not have an opportunity at all to win the election. And in the state offices, you have a provision again for a state representative or state senator for changing someone prior to the election. But again, you have the same problem, is that people have been voting for a three-week period. Senate Joint Resolution 19 provides the authority for the Secretary of State to hold a special election. The reason that is necessary, Mr. Chair and members, is that under the Constitution, it was interpreted by Legislative Council that the language in the Constitution is very specific, that you need to have the general election on the second Tuesday in November. And so to clarify that a special election might take place sometime other than the second Tuesday in November, this provides an opportunity to hold called a special election. 552 then is the implementing language, and what 552 says is that if a candidate for a state office, that means state representative, state senator, secretary, partisan office, secretary of state, and attorney general, treasurer, or the governor position, dies within 30 days of the vote, of the election date, then what would happen to that situation is that that particular race would be declared void at that point. The election, of course, would go on because there's many other candidates on the ballot, but that one would be voided. When the election day came, the county clerks would not then tally votes for that election so as not to prejudice the electorate for those candidates that were still eligible for being elected. Then the party of the deceased candidate would select a replacement candidate. And then a special election would be held so that there would be an opportunity to get that message out between the remaining candidates on the ballot and then the replacement candidate, whether they be, you know, Republican or Democrat, whoever was the deceased. But no sooner than January 2nd, but no then later than before the time at which we are seated in the legislature on the second Monday in January. What this does allow then is for that party to actually replace their candidate, allows the electorate to actually have an opportunity to vote for that candidate, and hopefully this is something that will not happen very, very often, but will take care of that problem that we have in which now, again, parties can name replacement candidates, but since many people would have already voted for other candidates, makes it virtually impossible for the party to actually have that candidate win. I think this provides closes that loop on the vote by mail election problem. Hopefully, this is something that will not have to be utilized very often. Again, Secretary of State is here, also Legislative Council. County clerks do support this proposal. Secretary of State made some very important and necessary timelines. These are the timelines they felt was necessary to make this work. The only other point is these measures, Mr. Chair, should move together because they are companion measures. And I see that there was a Ways and Means referral put on 552, but there really is no Ways and Means impact because you don't know when someone may die. So at that point, if something were to happen on a statewide level, would be the only cost, and then they just have to come to the e-board and the legislative body at that point if there was a death at the governor or secretary of state level and ask for reimbursement. That's it. I'm open to any questions or any comments you may have.
Any questions for President Barnhart?
Well, it isn't really a question. It's sort of a comment. I appreciate, Senator, that somebody, and probably you, is lying awake late at night thinking up things that need to be fixed in our election law and reading these kinds of constitutional and statutory provisions, because I will tell you that the story you just told us about the scenario in the gubernatorial race is something that never occurred to me. I'm very pleased to know that someone is ahead of us and thinking about these possibilities.
Yeah. Well, people do accuse me of thinking up all kinds of things in spare time, but...
Further questions, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions, if I may. Senator, you mentioned that under current law, mm-hmm. And your scenario was former Governor Kitzhaber mm-hmm. could serve for up to 2 years, even though he was term limited?
Mm-hmm. Right, and Mr. Rutlinger can answer that one more from a legal standpoint, but that would be the case, yes.
Okay. And then the other question is a very important one. Not that the other one wasn't, but I'm wondering if you are at war with Mr. Gillette. No. Not very important.
No. I appreciate
it. You don't have to answer that.
I appreciate that question.
Okay, further questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I thought I would share my story with Senator Metzger. Many years ago, a man, rather famous man by the name of Earl Long, as he got into his elderly time of life, found favor with a very young dancer of some questionable background. And for that reason, family members had him incarcerated into a because of mental incapacity. I noticed that you have that.
Originally, no longer.
And so he was there, but there was an election that took place after he was put there, and his name appeared on the ballot, and he won. And so his first act was to appoint Dr. McClendon, who was from my hometown, to the Department of Health, who had the authority to let him out. pencil, I thought you might.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, you know, that story did not come up, Representative, in the Senate side. However, we originally had the original language of the bill also had dealt with mental incapacity, and there were other issues that came up as a result of that, which is, and that may be one of the reasons that we decided just to limit this to the death of a candidate.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that's unclear to me, and maybe I missed it because I've come in a little late, I apologize. If the dead candidate doesn't win and someone were to be elected, then that person who ran in that election would have to start all over again, would they not, because the votes would not be counted?
No, what happens, Representative, thank you for the question. If someone of a major party candidate dies in that 30-day window, regardless of which party they are, then that election isn't held. So it's and the votes are not counted, and then a candidate is named as a replacement by that party. So there would not be the option of a dead candidate winning. They would name a replacement.
Follow up. I think you misunderstood my question.
Okay.
If they die within 30 days and the person who did not die has been campaigning for over a year, maybe 18 months, then all the work that they put into this race is then lost because the votes are not counted, correct? And they have to start all over again.
Well, they will be, of course, on the ballot 30 days later against the replacement candidate from the other party. But that's correct. I mean, they don't, that individual doesn't just, you know, get to go on and win because the other candidate died. Presumably, from a campaign standpoint, you know, one could certainly make the argument that that candidate certainly has a real leg up even then on the replacement candidate because they have been campaigning for a long time, whereas the replacement candidate from the other party is only going to have 30 days to get their message out. You know, it's all a matter of how you kind of, I guess, want to look you know, the advantage of that. But at least it does give the electorate the opportunity to actually elect that person rather than not being able to have that ability to do so.
To that point, Senator, you keep talking about 30 days later when, in fact, the election is almost 60 days later. Is that not true?
No, if someone dies within 30 days of the election date, so if it's November 3rd, let's say October 3rd, or in this case October 4th, I guess it's 31 days. If they die after October 4th, then the provisions of 552 take effect. If they die prior to that, then the old rules take effect because the county clerks still have an opportunity to change ballots to send out to folks. And so this would not be effective unless they get into that. This was basically worked on a date frame based on input from the county clerks and the Secretary of State's office. When you reach that line of no return where the ballots are out and you can't recall the ballots. If they die prior to that, let's say you die in September or August or July, then the old rules apply where the party simply names a candidate and the ballots and, you know, are adjusted and the campaign would go on as normal. This is only in that narrow window of time in which the vote-by-mail process is underway.
Right, but I guess what I'm seeing here in the proposed bill is that if you need a special election because somebody's died within that 30-day window, the election is not 30 days later, it's more like 60 days later.
Right, the election...
First week of January.
Right, exactly. There would be within, I believe it's within 5 days, Mr. Chair, of the election date, the party of the deceased candidate must name their replacement. And then the election is scheduled for no sooner than January 2nd, so you're right. The election itself would be 2 months after the original election, but still, it has to be held prior to the seating of the legislature in the second Monday of January.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you,
your testimony. John Lindbeck.
Good afternoon. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. The Elections Division and the Secretary of State do support this legislation. And here, the reason why is pretty simple. Under the current system, voters could be faced under tragic scenarios with a ballot in which they have a deceased candidate and other candidates who are not deceased and having to make that choice. We believe that the voters would like it better if they did not have a deceased candidate on the ballot. And what this legislation does is make the policy clear that we will not have deceased candidates on the ballot, and that voters will be given a choice between candidates who are all very much alive. We think voters will like that better, and that's why we support this legislation.
Question?
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. I recall a situation where there was an election in one of the Midwestern states, and the candidate died, and he was elected. They still went forth with the election, and he was elected. And then that was when the party appointed. Is that how we would be working now without this bill?
Under the current system, if a candidate died and the a candidate for governor died and that candidate won, there would be a special election later. If they didn't win, the person who won would assume the office.
I mean, right now?
Yes.
Wait, okay.
Representative Reinhart.
Thank you. This doesn't affect federal elections at all.
It does not.
So, President, U.S. Senator, U.S. Representative, not affected by this.
That's right.
What are the provisions in dealing with those situations if the candidate were to die in that period of time we're talking about?
As I recall, maybe Mr. Ettlinger can help me out with this, but I believe it calls for a special election.
That would be the way we would replace any of those people.
Right.
Of course, for the presidency, we're not electing a president anyway. We're electing electors, so that isn't a problem.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. No one further to testify on this bill. Let's close the public hearing, the joint public hearing on Senate Bill 552 and SJR 19. And the committee stand at ease for just a moment. 5-2. Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 552 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Backlund moves Senate Bill 552 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent Ways and Means referral be rescinded. Discussion. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I have concerns about the bill. I have concerns about the person who has campaigned for a long period of time and spent a lot of money and may have won the election, and I think it's unfair to that candidate. So I will respectfully be a no.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Bernhard.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Close, no.
Representative Forrest.
Excused.
Representative
Lawrence Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Burton.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
And chair votes aye. And carrier, anybody interested? Okay. Representative Backlund, be the carrier. Senate Bill 552 is referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded. Now open up a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 19. Move Senate SJR 19 forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move. What is our
SJR 19?
I move SJR 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes. Representative Backlund has moved SJR 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion.
Mr. Chair, could you repeat the motion?
Yes, SJR 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Right.
No discussion? Okay, let's call the roll.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative
Reinhardt. Aye.
Representative Close.
Close, no.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
And Chair Doyle.
And Chair votes aye. And I'll ask Representative Backlund to carry this as well as a companion bill. And SJR 19 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we close the work session on SJR 19. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3000. Representative Tudy Smith.
Chair, I'm Representative Tudy Smith from House District 18, and I support House Bill 3000 with the Dash 4 amendments. House Bill 3000 with the Dash 4 amendments will aid Oregon school districts, which are struggling to make their ends meet during these tough budget times. What this bill does, it allows the Department of Administrative Services to develop an allowable growth factor using standards set by Legislative Fiscal and the Legislative Revenue Office. Each year, districts will be allowed an allowable growth factor for that year as well as for the next 5 years. This will allow school districts and other negotiating units to enter into collective bargaining talks with solid numbers that have a standard for their development. The bill will allow school boards and school districts to develop their own operating budgets. They can then enter into contracts, agreements, and collective bargaining negotiations, having an idea of what they can do within their budget by using an allowable growth factor. The bill can allow districts to do three things. They can make an offer based on the allowable growth factor, or choose to negotiate less, or make an offer that exceeds the allowable growth factor. If they make an offer that exceeds the allowable growth factor, then they have to explain why in a report. And the report must specify the rationale for expenditures and why the allowable growth factor needs to be increased. The report would be required to have a fiscal impact statement explaining why there is a need to exceed it. The student achievement statement, meaning how the district or how the increase will affect student achievement in the district. And a collective bargaining unit agreement or individual contract that contains an offer above the allowable growth factor may not be ratified until 30 days after the date of the report has been released. During these tough times in Oregon where our school districts need whatever help we can give them, this is an opportunity for school districts to start controlling their costs and talk about the current resources. By adopting House Bill 3000 with the dash 4 amendments, we will give school districts a starting point in the budget writing process. In addition, this bill will allow for more dollars to get into the classroom rather than being tied up in administrative costs. Any questions?
Do you want to? How about if we have Senator Beyer? Why don't you go ahead if you have things to add, and then we'll take questions after that.
Thank you, Mr. President. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee. What's the motion there, Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I'm here to support House Bill 3000 with the dash. I actually have the dash 3 amendment. I believe it has a dash 4 that is virtually the same thing. I'm here to speak on behalf of the dash 4 amendments. This bill, with these amendments, is very similar to a bill that died at the Speaker's desk in 1999 upon Sonny Dye. The bill never came up for third reading because we Sonny Dye before it got there. But what the world we lived in then, the completely, really different world than we live in today, the bill was a good bill, an important bill at that time, and it's even more important today. And I say that because at that point in time, we were in a time of Oregon and unprecedented growth in economy and budget at the state level. And there was seemed to be more than ample funding to go around. Every revenue forecast was going the opposite way we are seeing them now. They were, each one was increasingly higher. We were in a time that the legislature seemed to want to stay here forever to see what the next revenue forecast was, because we would have more money to spend. It's exactly opposite what we have today, where we all want to get out of town as soon as possible before we find out what the next bad news is come September. But what this bill does is very important, because school districts, in their negotiations of their contracts, they need to know, you know, have some certainty, need to know what it is they can expect. And both the school board and the union need to understand how much money there is and how much money should be allocated to salaries. And that's what this bill does, is it gives both sides some certainty on what's available for the collective bargaining agreements. And that's what we need to do to allow our people in our local districts to understand that their school districts, their both their school boards and their, you know, the teachers unions there, are doing what's right for the people of the area. And I think that's the point I'd like to make. I'd also, I'm sure it's been stated already, but this bill almost mirrors Executive Order Number EO-15, signed by Governor Kitzhaber in 1999. That was, I think, after that bill died at the Speaker's desk in 99, and the governor then realized how important it is that we can, local school districts can know what's coming and what to expect from the legislature, and then they in turn have a backstop, so to speak, to in their negotiations. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions anyone would have on it. But I urge you to adopt the dash 4 amendments and move the bill to the floor, and we can get it moving through the system as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a slide presentation?
Yes. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I'm with the Senate Republican Caucus Office. I do have a short slide presentation. I believe most of the items have been covered, but if you'd like me to, I would be happy to go over the slides with you.
Do you mind sticking around a little bit?
Okay. Thank you.
Just to give a little background, when I first came to work for Senator Clarno in the Republican Caucus, and I was told my position was going to be doing education policy, I met with quite a few superintendents from her district, and it was a reoccurring theme that they were asking for some leverage during the collective bargaining process. And Senator Beyer had remembered this bill during the 99 session, and it really seemed to be a good compromise to work through, and it didn't have too many loopholes or counterpoints that could be made against it, because it really is good policy. So with that, I'll proceed with the presentation. This is just an overview. Obviously, the K-12 budget and asking yourself what does it cost to provide a quality education in Oregon is a very speculative number. That's one of the things I'd like to talk about during this presentation. Also, sustainability. We hear, and you as members of the House, and I know members of the Senate also hear over and over again, we need to develop a sustainable system for K-12. Again, the legislative endorsed, this bill would be a legislative endorsement of current policy. And also, I think most importantly, it echoes transparency within government. It allows policymakers to get information about their school districts, and it also allows the communities to know about what's going on beyond just what they read in the paper. So what does it cost to provide a quality education to children in Oregon? Well, as I had said, it's a highly speculative number. I'm sure each one of you at the dais have a different number in your mind as you approach this budgeting crisis that we're dealing with this session. One of the things that we all know is that costs vary from child to child. And within an accountable system, we have to recognize that you reach a point of diminishing returns. And that's for every budget. You can't just throw money at a problem and hope it solves itself. Lastly, many factors need to be considered when you identify what that cost is for a quality education. So I'm not here to say what that number is. There's quite a few different numbers floating around there. There's quite a few numbers that have gone through this process over the last decade. So currently, the way I perceive the problem is that there are current factors that are used in determining the cost of a quality education. And I think the number one is the collective bargaining process. Also, behind that are health care benefits and salary and step increases. Finally, COLA and other factors. And these are really the main keys that are determined when the budget process goes through in the different school districts. And really, if it was a perfect world, the things that we'd be thinking of are teacher-to-student ratios, access to resources, access to information, adequate facilities, and engaging and inspirational teachers, regardless of the cost of paying the teachers. So sustainability, where does Oregon start? Well, obviously we start where the largest cost is. And according to Econ Northwest reports prepared by or for the OSBA, 80 to 85% of costs go to teacher salaries and benefits. Now, these are also numbers from OSBA's salary survey that they've done. You see there's a wide variance of salary. Also, the contributions to insurance and the teachers' contributions. So, surprisingly, you also see quite a variance in steps, anywhere from a negative 3 to a positive 8% growth in step increases. So when you look at spending trends, and you factor step increases, COLAs, health care, salary, and benefits are not only the largest portion of the K-12 budget, they're also the fastest growing. And I think it can be argued that currently, the way the collective bargaining process is, it artificially inflates the cost or the growth of the K-12 budget every biennium. So the recipe for disaster, because we have growth in education budget that could outweigh the growth that we see in revenue, which is what we're seeing this year. Just again echoing executive order number EO15 on December 15th, 1999, shortly after the session, Governor Kitzhaber had signed this order instructing DAS to develop this allowable growth factor. And just a few last points with the DAS 4 amendments. It allows policymakers to identify trends and create solutions as they perceive them from the reporting mechanism within the DASH 4 amendments. And finally, with the DASH 4 amendments, it does create a transparent government, which I think is very important, especially considering K through 12 budgets take up nearly one half of our entire state's budget.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions about this. I wonder if I could ask two or three.
Yep.
I'm wondering about this allowable growth factor. With the property tax that we passed in this state, the property tax limit, the cut and cap, property taxes can increase 3% per year regardless of market conditions. So if people's property lose value, they still get the increase of 3% every year. So is there any stipulation that if school districts had increasing costs and wanted to have reductions in salaries, that would not be allowed? It would always increase. Is that correct?
I guess I would have to default to an expert, somebody from revenue, to answer that question. I don't see anything within the language about a decrease in spending through the allowable growth factor, but I think that would be a question better answered through a fiscal officer.
Well, I guess if I can nail it down further, Mr. Chair, is the growth factor automatic? Is it always? Does it always go into effect? I mean, could you have salary freezes with this bill?
Well, as Representative Smith testified, there's really this bill doesn't lock anybody down to a specific number. It does allow you to start with that allowable growth factor, and if the school board can budget at a lower percentage of growth, they're welcome to do that. And they can also budget at a higher percentage of growth than the allowable growth factor. However, if that happens, a fiscal report would be issued. And I believe...
Representative, I'm thinking Mr. Marshall is going to be testifying to this
okay.
a little later. He might be able to respond to that question.
Go ahead.
Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess I'd just like to point out, I believe that this bill isn't speaking only to local revenues, but to the entire K-12 budget, and we as policymakers, when we decide on a number for K-12, we factor in that positive and or negative growth of local revenues, and this bill is speaking to the entire K-12 budget as set by the legislature. So in effect, we can, we control or we make adjustments for that positive or negative revenue at the local level, because those are offsets to the total number, and in theory all students in the state of Oregon receive the same amount of money. So if you've got a local district where you've got shrinking property values, they are going to be getting a higher number of general fund dollars and a lower number of local property tax dollars versus an area where you've got growing local revenues. So it's a statewide number. It's not a district-by-district number.
So, Senator, if you were to go into an economic downturn and we had devaluation, which hasn't happened for many, many years or decades, but decreasing costs, decreasing prices, how would this bill fit into that?
Well, I believe the allowable growth factor then set by the Department of Administrative Services would be a negative number.
They could do that. Okay. One last question,
Mr.
Chair.
Sure.
The total combined compensation that you talk about in Section 4,
if you, does this include all the retirement costs? I mean, if you had a situation where the PERS legislation we've passed is thrown out by the courts and those costs continue to escalate, are those costs added into this total combined compensation figure?
Good question.
Looks like Mr. Marshall might be able to respond to that one as well.
I just bring it up, Mr. Chair, because Linn County has looked at doing that with their county budget, mm-hmm. trying to say that the total package has to include those costs, and that's why we have to control them. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question could be directed to either Senator Beyer or Representative Smith. I note that there is a term here, a limit, the next 5 fiscal years. Can you explain why you picked 5, why not 2, why any?
Representative Smith, just to give school districts stability in their planning and budget process, and that allowable growth factor can also change every year with the economic conditions as set forth in our state forecasting and so forth. So again, school districts, something to look forward to. You know, in some of my local school districts, many times school districts put in a salary package during the midterm biennium, hoping that the state will allocate more money to pay for their salary packages. Well, in this particular economic downturn, as we know, school districts got less money, not more. So it just gives them some stability in planning.
Follow up. Would that include then, say, 5 years from, say, July 1, 2003 to then July 1, 2008?
I think it's January.
January 1 mm-hmm. to 2008. Mm-hmm. And then that would be removed?
No, it would just extend out for every year. I mean,
so it would be in perpetuity?
Yeah, with changes every year. But, you know, the forecasting would be, you know, 5 years.
Follow up on that?
Sure, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you.
Those numbers, though, could change.
They could change. They could go up or they could go down.
Representative Barnhart.
This is the nature of a follow-up as well. I'm still trying to get my head around this amendment because I only just saw it today. If I understand that point that Representative Backlund raised, the department would issue an allowable growth factor for each of 5 years. Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, so what that would mean then is, if I understand it right, if this bill had been effected in 2001, in January 1st of 2002, they would have put out a growth factor, an allowable growth factor for the next 5 years, and by now, that would be wildly off, wouldn't it?
Chair, Representative Backlund, but that is adjusted every year as we go out.
Right.
So, you know, it wouldn't be off because we would have made a correction for 2002.
Okay, well, that leads to another follow-up.
I'm sorry, it's a rolling 5 years, isn't it? Okay. Representative Barnhart?
That's what I understood it to be. But let's suppose that a school district made an offer under Section 4 that meets the allowable growth factor for the next 5 years on January 2nd, 2002. And therefore locked their budget in, as it were, for the next 5 years under that section of the bill, of the amendment. Wouldn't that then lead to very large increases in all likelihood above what we could actually afford given the downturn we've had?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, in this case it probably would have, but I would argue that that's what happened anyway. So that at least this way, you know, both sides could say, come to us, the legislature, and say, look, you told us this is what we're going to have. This is what we did. It's your fault. So I guess I would argue that this just makes it better.
Okay. So it is possible to blame the legislature for funding. Okay. Thank you.
Well, and Executive Order 19 was in place.
15.
Or 15, sorry. So, right, but isn't this the model that they had used, you know, pretty much since 99 based on the governor's?
Well,
requirements. Further comments?
Okay. Well, I'm one, and it may not be the right, this may not be the right panel to ask it on, but I'd love to see a copy of Executive Order 15. I don't believe I've ever seen it.
All right.
I'd be happy to provide the
great
committee
with
that.
Thank you. Thank you for testimony. Richard Leonetti.
I'm Richard Leonetti. I'm with Oregon Tax Research. I'm a researcher. I'm here to, before I start, I'd really like to correct something. The numbers you saw on the board about teacher salaries and benefits are wildly wrong. I don't know where they came from, but they sure don't match what the state education department puts out. These are way low compared to what's really going on in the world. And I will be happy to submit those to you if you'd like, but these aren't correct by a country mile. Now to the bill, the amendments. In principle, I agree with your amendments. I think it should be done. I think you should set the budget and the school district should live with it. I have some doubts whether this will really get the whole thing done the way you'd like it. I wanted to tell you why I believe this may not result in what you really want. As his chart showed, the bare-knuckled problem here is wages and benefits. There's no way to get around that. This bill might work for the wages portion. And if you stay away from Portland, it might work for the health care portion. But what it won't work for is things like you raised a minute ago, PERS, retirement, those sort of things. Those are not contract, it could be contract negotiable, but there's a practical matter, they don't do it that way. I mean, we could have had, when the PERS rates went up, they could have negotiated their contracts that the employee pays instead of 6%, he pays 12%. No one tried that. It never happened. It never will happen. And what really happens here is that anything the legislature mandates, small example, SimCam, mainstreaming, big example being really PERS, that's the monster in the barn here. You mandate the benefits for PERS. You come back as a legislature, and they've done it, there's been amendments to the PERS bill every year going back for years and years and years and years, and you say, you have to pay this. And the attitude of the school district is, well, then we better go back to the legislature, cry on their shoulder, because they made us do it. And that's the weakness of even this approach. Anything you leave in here that allows them to come back every year and cry, or every other year, and cry, you're up a creek. You've got real problems with that. Now, give you an example. In 1991, there's a chart attached. It wasn't made for this purpose, but it's kind of instructive. In 1991, thereabouts, the legislature said, we're going to equalize spending, more or less, approximately. And this is a graph that shows total spending per average daily attendance, adjusted for the CPI, which I'll come back to. That's a very high adjustment, in my opinion, but that's what I did. And you said, all right, we're going to equalize spending. Well, the top line is Portland, Oregon, Portland School District number one. Portland got religion, if you look at that chart. For 1, 2, 3, 4 years in a row, they reduced their spending in CPI-adjusted terms per student. Aha! 95, 96 comes along, and they discovered that they can come to the legislature and cry a lot. You passed a bill, for example, that took their busing costs out of their budget or gave them extra money for it. They got the city to give them money. They got Multnomah County to give them money. But the point was, if you look at the chart, they got a second credit card somewhere in the middle 90s there and used it. And any time you set mandates for them that are expensive mandates, they're going to have the ability to come back and say to you, and you have really no good way to turn them down, that, no, I'm sorry, we need the money, you've got to give it to us. Now, having said that, I still want you to pass this thing. There's another way to do. First of all, had you done something, I mean, you did something with FERS, but had you changed it to a defined contribution program, you would have taken this out of this equation. You would have then had a negotiable item, something that the school districts would have to negotiate over, or wouldn't have to, but they'd be crazy if they didn't. But then it's a fixed cost like everything else. Right now, their attitude is, it goes up, that's nice. And that's why I think it was so important to start PERS over with a defined contribution program, which did not happen that way. I think it would have stood up in the courts better than we're going to fare too, but that's a side issue. Another way you could do it, and I'll just give you an example, you could send a firm, hard number, not determined by legislative, fiscal, not none of those things. Set a number in stone and say, that will be the number, period. Now, it may not work, but at least a suggestion. When they come back to the legislature, you have an answer then, at least. It's already done. The number is set in stone. You get this growth factor. That's it. We don't want to talk to you about it. It would be easier to resist the crying, I guess, is what I'm saying. Go back a session ago. The governor proposed an education budget that everybody thought was high. The Republicans outbid him, and the Democrats outbid the Republicans. So it just escalated dramatically last time, 2 years ago. So if there was a default number, and I would suggest that the default number be something like the CPI plus a percent or percent and a half. Now the CPI, Federal Reserve will tell you, CPI overstates the cost of living between 1 and 2%. There's a lot of argument about where, but at least 1 to 2% the CPI is overstated as far as relating to the cost of living. So if you set a number that was 1.5%, even 2% over the CPI, and set it in stone, and said that's the number, and they can then negotiate salaries, they can negotiate health benefits, they can negotiate retirement costs, they can negotiate their own class sizes, but they can't negotiate fewer days. That would be the magic word. That way, if they get foolish with their money, it'll be transparent to every citizen in their district that says, why have we got 40 kids in the class? Well, we decided we'd rather have 40 kids in the class and give our teachers a bigger raise than the 6% the legislature gave us. Now, that's really the nub of the matter. Until you get some way to get a handle on this, it's going to bite you forever and ever and ever, in my opinion. And I don't think, as long as PERS is there, it's going to be very difficult. But this would give you a way. There's no reason that when PERS costs went up, they couldn't have negotiated that the employee's 6% contribution went up. They didn't. Nobody expected them to, as part of the reason, but you could take the monkey off your back by picking a number. I don't care if the number's high, because historically, they've exceeded every high number you could dream up in this room, I think, right now. I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Close.
I was just curious. You said that the CPI overestimates the cost of living by 1 to 2%. Can you tell me why that is?
Yes, it's the way it's figured, but I mean, historically, the way they've done this basket of groceries, let me give you an example. When the computer was, my first computer cost $5,000. That same computer today is about $699. But the basket, I mean, the way they figure that basket, they put in something at $5,000, not the fact that it costs me less. The Federal Reserve has a whole series of papers, and I didn't bring it with me, but on their website, estimating what this is. I mean, I won't blanket say this, but 99 out of 100 economists will tell you the CPI understates the cost of living significantly. And particularly this last year. I mean, this last year was dramatic. I think we went backwards here, but that's another matter.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart.
Well, this is sort of a follow-up on that. Do you know, now, the cost of living, of course, is based on this consumer price index is what CPI stands for. is based on what it actually costs, or at least an estimate of what it costs, for a family to live. What we're talking about, of course, is what the costs are for a school district to buy the various things that it needs in order to run schools. Do we have an index for that? Or if we don't, how would you go about devising one?
Well, let me back up. First of all, the CPI is not the cost of living by any means. It's a flawed index. They've been running a parallel index for years that they won't release. But as a political matter, it would be very touchy to say the CPI overstates the world because it's in too many labor contracts, quite honestly. The second part of your question, yes, I think the cost of living is a relevant number as far as school costs, because I disagree with the 85%. It's more like 75%. 75% is wages and benefits, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all the money is. You can talk about everything else connected with schools, about what the buildings cost to operate and what the janitors get. It's all wages and benefits. And it's I realize the big gorilla in the lobbying business is the teachers union, but at some point you've got to face up to it. But that's what you're talking about when you're talking about financing a school. You're not talking about what the paper costs or any of those other things. You're really talking about wages and benefits. Give me an idea. I ran a private business for a long, long time, almost 40 years. We set our wage scales, and I'm sure I've got lots of friends in this business, but we had about 6 pay rates, give or take a few. 6, 8, 5, depending where we were. But top to bottom, there wasn't a huge spread. The Portland School District has 122 pay slots. And top to bottom, it's ridiculous. The starting salary you can't hire a good teacher for on any stretch of the imagination. And the top salaries, in my opinion, and this is an opinion, in my opinion, they can't find those salaries anywhere in the world if they had to go out and find a job. I mean, again, he showed the highest salary of teachers in the state at $48,000. Well, over half the Portland teachers earn more than $48,000. In fact, 28% of them earn $61,367, plus about a $20,000 benefit package, and they've got, you know, 12, 13 weeks vacation, all the rest of it. An $800 a month health benefit. My point is, they can afford to do this only because they do it first, come see you second, and say, send us the money. And that's what your bill is aimed at trying to take care of. All I want to raise in front of you is that it may not work the way you'd like it to. It still can be gone. You're still going to have them on your doorstep. And that maybe, and this is just a maybe, if you set a number in stone, it would be harder to get on your doorstep than get a hearing. That was my point. And it may not be. There may be a third way here somewhere, but a fourth or a fifth. But I just want to make sure you understand what the difficulty is really going to be in trying to make this thing work for you.
Further questions? Representative Monsanto.
This one. I'm trying to understand exactly your point when you're talking about salaries. What's wrong with paying a teacher who has been in the system for 25 years, excellent teacher, has done, affected thousands and thousands of lives, have produced a product that goes out into society and becomes a well-rounded, adjusted person that contributes to society? What's wrong with paying a teacher?
Okay, let me answer the question.
$48,000.
When I hired people, we paid as much as we had to get the kind of quality we wanted. For example, if I'll jump on poor Portland because that's the one I know the best. Portland's teachers earn roughly $10,000 more in salary and $10,000 more in benefits at the top, Catlin Gable, Jesuit, and the Episcopal School. And I don't think anybody would call those three high schools in my area and say, they are lousy schools. You're not going to do that. The point is not what is nice to pay them, but when you're short, you've got to say, what do we have to pay them? Because the trade-off from what you have to pay to what you'd like to pay them, is the children end up with short school years and very large class sizes. There's no way to hide from that. Those are the trade-offs you're making. How short do you want your school year, and how many people do you want in a class? Now, why can Jesuit and Episcopal and these people hire for so much less money than us? Well, it gives me a hint that we're probably paying more than we need to. Not more than my favorite teacher maybe would, I'd like to pay her, but more than we need to keep her or him.
Okay. Further questions? All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Brian Reeder.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder from the Department of Education, here today on behalf of Superintendent of Public Instruction Susan Castillo. I have a letter from the superintendent to the chair and the committee members. This was written last night before the Dash 4 amendments were available, so they addressed the Dash 3 amendments. The superintendent opposes the Dash 3 amendments, and I would also indicate that she will oppose the Dash 4 amendments for the same reasons. First, a couple of technical reasons, and also some policy reasons. First, I'd like to address the technical reasons. You heard Representative Beyer and Mr. Cleave indicate that the Dash 4 amendments are very similar to Executive Order 15. That is not the case. There's a critical difference between both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4s and Executive Order 15. That difference is that Executive Order 15 has a very clear criteria upon which the allowable growth factor is based, and that criteria is current service level, which is fairly well defined in practice in state government and fairly well understood as a concept. The cost in a given year of providing the same level of services that was provided in the prior year. If you look at the Dash 3 amendments, they have absolutely no criteria upon which this allowable growth factor is based. They simply turn it over to the Department of Administrative Services. That is a critical policy issue that this body should be making, the legislature, not the Department of Administrative Services. If you look at the Dash 4 amendments, page 2, lines 21 and 22, it states that, well, actually back up to line 19, the allowable growth factor shall reflect the current market conditions of this state and shall be within the forecasted state revenues allocated for school districts and education service districts. Well, that's quite vague what that means. It really gives no guidance on how to actually make the calculation. Again, this is turning over the calculation of this important number to the Department of Administrative Services with little or no guidance on what the intent is or what the criteria are for calculating that number. The letter also addresses some timing issues. The Dash 3 amendments indicate an April 15th date. That's a little bit troublesome because it doesn't, for districts who are involved in salary negotiations, it really doesn't give them enough time. It's too late in the year. I believe the Dash 4s have a January 1 date, which would be preferable. The other aspect of the Dash 4s that is very troubling to the superintendent is the ability of districts to unilaterally end the collective bargaining process simply by offering salary and benefit increases that are up to the level of the allowable growth factor. If the district offers that, then no negotiations are allowed. in a situation we're facing today where the state budget has declined for schools, has declined dramatically during the year. If the allowable growth factor were adjusted to reflect that, we might be looking at something like minus 10%, in which case a district could simply cut the salaries and benefits of their employees by 10%, and no negotiations would be allowed. Final point that I would like to make on the behalf of the superintendent is that this moves the state of Oregon about a whisper's breath away from statewide collective bargaining, and it is the strong belief of the superintendent that those issues belong at the local level, that the needs and the policy decisions about compensation and benefits vary tremendously around the state, and they need to be made at the local level because they need to be different in different parts of the state. With that, I will answer any questions.
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. Tricia Bozak and Tricia Smith. Representing the Gorillas. Hello, Hubby.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union of 20,000 classified and certified education professionals working in Oregon's K-12 ESD and community colleges. And I am here to testify in opposition to the Dash 4 amendments. I also would testify in opposition to Dash 3, only it's not clear to me that you are considering those amendments. So should you consider them later, count me as a no, please. The Dash 4 amendments, in our opinion, are a vague way of eliminating collective bargaining for our members in school districts by allowing school districts to make and implement an offer based on an arbitrary growth factor in lieu of negotiating with our members. We find to be an unjustified and unwarranted attack on our ability to bargain with our employers over wages and benefits and working conditions. Not only does the allowable growth factor language in the Dash 4 amendment allow the compensation package to be implemented, but it also eliminates our ability to bargain any other issues. And it carries forward issues from the prior contract into the next contract without discussion. We believe that those issues should be negotiated each time if local members feel that there are issues that need to be discussed with their employers. The collective bargaining agreement is the mechanism that we have to discuss working conditions and changes in those conditions, and we see no justification for changing that mechanism. If the legislature wants to talk about statewide bargaining or modifying the collective bargaining law, we would like to have certainly a far more full discussion of that issue than we're having now, and we would like to discuss kind of a straight-up bill rather than this backdoor approach to eliminate employees' opportunity to discuss these issues with employers if employers choose not to discuss them. We also are concerned about a state agency, specifically the Department of Administrative Services, establishing this allowable growth factor without any criteria in the bill. We don't want to say anything negative about anybody, but forecasting hasn't been our strong suit in Oregon in the recent past, and it would worry us that DAS's ability to forecast 5 years into the future determines our members' ability to make a living today. And we think that that's what this bill does, is set up that situation where state agency employees, based on their own criteria, determine what the cost of living for classified school employees in Burns would be. And we don't think that that's a good approach, and we certainly hope that you don't consider it any further than this hearing today. With that, I'll answer questions.
Okay. Ms. Bozak, why don't you go first, and then we'll look for questions to the panel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent certified and classified employees in the K-12 arena and also in community colleges. I, too, am here in opposition to the Dash 4 and the Dash 3 amendments, if they're before you, to House Bill 3000. Some have alluded to the executive order that passed in 1999. I want to echo Mr. Reeder's comments that they are vastly different. They're similar in name, but not in nature. I think the executive order was more prescriptive about what went into that factor, as opposed to what is in the Dash 4 amendments.
Ms. Bozak, just while you're on that subject, does that mean then that Executive Order 15 is not being followed because they're not using current service level as a factor? I mean,
no, Mr. Chair, that's not what I meant to imply. It's just I think there's more meat to that in that executive order than appears in this bill. In fact, it is used to set up the State Revenue Forecast Committee that meets in the interim and annually to set that growth factor. That's been the case since that executive order was issued. We would, too, have concern about the five-year forecast. I think Tricia put it well about the difficulty of doing that and putting DAS in that position to virtually make those decisions for local school districts throughout the state. This bill also focuses a great deal and totally on compensation and not other costs that school districts may incur, some of which they may have no control over. Granted that personnel costs are a great deal of the budget, but it doesn't take into account some of those other decisions. I think one of the things to think about as you consider this is this allowable growth factor versus contrasted with looking at local school districts and local school boards determining local need and local priority of their patrons. I think it limits some of those decisions in a big way. For instance, if you have a district who has high turnover and low salaries juxtaposed next to a district that has high salaries and low turnover, if you apply this, as I understand it, the allowable growth factor to that, you're never going to close that gap. In fact, that gap increases between the salaries that can be offered and whether or not that other district can be competitive. So I see that as something that might be a problem. I want to touch on the collective bargaining piece of this because this is obviously a great concern to us. I think, obviously, the Dash 4 amendments give undue advantage to school boards and total advantage to them in the bargaining process, virtually gutting the bargaining process. And I think it strongly goes against the spirit and the purpose of the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. It gives that unilateral advantage to school districts to make an offer to employees and then implement that offer. I think the words in the amendment are in lieu of negotiating. So all that they have to do is put that on the table, and that ceases all bargaining on all issues, not just economic issues. I think the petitioning to ERB, the appeals that can go to the Employment Relations Board, I think we're going to get into constant challenges to these. A similar type of scheme was put into effect in Wisconsin some years ago, which led to repeated litigation and constant litigation on something they called a qualified economic offer, but it works very similarly to this. I just urge you to contrast what appears the purpose of this amendment is to the policy statements that is in the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, where it talks about that the people of the state have a fundamental interest in the development of our harmonious and cooperative relationships between government and its employees. And it goes on to talk about the right of employees to organize and negotiate collectively, safeguards employees and the public from injury and impairment and interruptions in necessary services. It also goes on to talk about establishing greater equality of bargaining power between public employers and public employees. I think that this amendment runs totally counter to that public policy statement, and we would oppose the amendment on those grounds. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. What do you think of the original bill?
Very
I'm a little study.
I'm a little study. Just has like four lines.
Yeah. I would just suggest to the members that the original bill is not up for consideration. So it's either the, most, in fact, at this point, it's only the dash fours.
Well, Mr. Chair, on that issue, if I may, I think what we've heard so far today suggests that this is an extremely complex area that certainly needs an evaluation and study, but I don't think it's one that is within the resources of this committee at this time and the time we have left in the session. So my question may have sounded flip, but it was meant meant purposely that this is an issue that ought to be considered, but I don't see how it's possible for us to get there with the resources we have and the time we have.
So noted. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like to have a discussion with you more than just ask you questions, because I think that we really all want the same thing, and that is we want good schools, and we want employees to be treated fairly, and we want employers to have a level playing field, and all those good things that we've talked about over the years since we've known each other. But I am concerned because my emails reflect to me that people feel that school boards, rather than having, as you put it, the unfair advantage in this, that they are unable to do a good job, because they're all a part of the community and all apart. They're dealing with their friends. So in the collective bargaining, in other words, that they're giving away the store. That's a perception. Then they read in the paper that the comparison of salaries to other states, and they start trying to look at those comparisons. And then Superintendent of Education, Susan Castile, said, for the quality education model, we need 6.1 in '01, and now it's 6.9, up 13%. I have to be totally honest with you. This just sets people on edge, and they just get furious, and then they start emailing people like me about why we're doing this. And they voiced many of the concerns that you've heard today from Mr. Leonetti, that talking about these different things. So I think, to be honest with you, we face a crisis here. So this is not what you want for an answer. My question then is, what do you think we need to do to help straighten out the kind of situation that we have, if not the dash fours?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'll try first. Representative, I'm having difficulty moving past the assumption, the underlying assumption, that school employees are overpaid.
Okay.
I do not agree with that assumption.
Okay.
From an ideological standpoint, I can find very few things in this world that are more important in work than educating our children. So it's a very important task, and I know you all agree with that. And in America, where we presumably pay based on value, it would be hard for me to say that $40,000 a year is too much money to pay a teacher to teach a child or thousands of children over her career. I don't believe that exorbitant employee costs, that is, the cost of wages, is too much in schools. We have costs in education that are skyrocketing, and we're trying to control. We have other bills before the legislature to try to deal with those increasing costs. House Bill 3639, heard before this committee last week, is one of those bills that we believe would help hold down costs to schools for the provision of education services to children. We think that it's entirely appropriate for the legislature and school districts
to look at every single thing that they do and determine that the costs that are being paid for those things are appropriate. We don't believe that four gets you there, if that's your intent. We agree with the intent to assure that we are not paying more than we should for the provision of education. We disagree that our members are overpaid in that process.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for those comments. So if wages and salaries and so forth are not the driving cost of the spiraling demand on money, do you see it that it's in other areas? For instance, millions going into health care for retirees, not those that are still working. Do you see other costs like that that are playing a big role?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, ma'am.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Sorry. Representative Ross Anderson.
I have a little different tact. I've been hearing from school board members that are saying, just to set the record straight, I'm having real issues with the Dash 4 amendments regarding the growth factor. But what I'm hearing from school board members is so much of their time now is spent in bargaining. And it deals primarily, not necessarily with the wages, which I feel are all right, but primarily with the benefits portion of it, which is skyrocketing. I don't know if this bill would actually help that situation, because I feel the health care costs are going to continue to go up. But I would love to see time limits put on the amount of time that bargaining would need to take place, so that school board members don't think they're just going from one bargaining session right into a next. So that's just the comment I wanted to make. Don't know if you have a response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, I mean, there are timelines in the laws that exist, and I think they're probably sometimes those longer negotiations. I think probably both parties play some role in lengthening those out. I think in the vast majority of places, it's not a prolonged endeavor. Some of these get to get down to business and get things resolved rather quickly. And I think we're seeing that a lot in the current fiscal environment. So I understand the frustration of some. We hear that from our side of the table as well, about issues that prolong bargaining. They feel like unnecessarily, but I think it's a process largely that works well and that serves both sides well when they get a negotiated agreement.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your testimony. John Marshall.
Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and appearing before you this afternoon in support of the proposed Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3000. I believe a fundamental issue that school boards face in their collective bargaining negotiations is a circumstance very similar to what you and the legislature face every 2 years. And that is, how do you allocate limited resources amongst very valuable yet competing needs? And it seems to me the issue that school boards face is trying to strike a balance between the salaries and benefit packages for existing employees, which, as was suggested, amounts to an average of 80-85% of school districts' budget, against the 15-20% of the school district's budget that I would consider available for a program. That is purchasing instructional materials, fixing a leaky roof, adding additional specialists to assist those kids that need help with reading or math or science, or adding additional programs and staff or electives to keep kids engaged in school at the high school level. So the issue is, how do you allocate resources so that you can limit the amount of dollars that go to existing salaries and benefits while preserving some resources for those other areas, which I call program enhancement. We believe that the Dash 4 amendments get to assisting school boards in dealing with that very fundamental question of the collective bargaining process and budgeting in general. I think there's been some confusion surrounding the Dash 4 amendments and the executive order that created the School Revenue Forecast Committee. I've served on that committee. And the purpose of that committee was to try to give school districts some estimate of revenue that, using the terms of the executive order, they could reasonably expect to receive over a period of time. And it was essentially a current service level approach. What would a current service level budget for schools off a couple years down the road look like, given the anticipated growth in local resources, state general fund and lottery resources, as well as a general fund budget relating to the cost drivers of personnel, materials and supplies, and so forth. So it was really an anticipation of revenue that hopefully school districts could have in their hand and use when they made long-term budgeting decisions. That is, budgeting decisions that extend longer than a year in either a collective bargaining agreement, superintendent's contract, or some other arrangement whereby they're committing the expenditure of funds. What the Dash 4 amendments do are strictly to look at compensation. And compensation is defined broadly. It's not only salaries, but it includes a broad range of benefits. And I would direct your attention to the definition of total compensation on page 1 of the proposed amendment, starting at line 10. It's base salaries, death in column, longevity, tuition reimbursement, retirement contributions, co-curricular extra duty pay, but also includes the wide variety of benefits and associated payroll costs, PERS, Social Security, workers' comp, and so forth. So what the proposed amendments suggest is that the Department of Administrative Services would calculate, based on the best information they have about estimates in growth of the overall economy, salaries and wages, benefits, both on the PERS side, health insurance, and so forth, and come up with a growth factor. A growth factor over the next 5 years, probably on an annual basis, with some educated estimate of what compensation should be. The work that, and I've been very impressed, by the way, with the work that the DAS staff, as well as using legislative fiscal, legislative revenue, the Department of Education have done relative to the Revenue Forecast Committee in coming up with revenue. And I don't question for a minute their ability to also bring a group of folks together from all parties to look at the cost drivers of compensation. Once they produce that allowable growth factor, and it's given to school districts by January 1 of each year, so that when school districts go into the budgeting process or begin collective bargaining between the first of the year generally and the end of the fiscal year on June 30, they have this information before them. Now, what's different about the Dash 4 amendments is that it grants some leverage to the local school board. And that is, it allows, it doesn't demand, it doesn't require, but it allows the local school board to have this allowable growth factor in hand. And if the school board believes at some time that the demands from the unions on compensation exceed what the Department of Administrative Services suggests is a reasonable level of growth, given all the economic conditions that they look at, as well as anticipated growth for both state and local revenue to school districts, the board can say, wait a minute, it's over. We're going to propose unilaterally this contract that fits within this allowable growth factor, a level of reasonable growth in the total compensation of employees, and we're going to stop bargaining. I can envision, as I believe, in certain circumstances that a board may decide to exceed that allowable growth factor. That may be because they're competing with neighboring districts for staff. There are some good people they want to retain. There are some language issues of the contract that they're interested in either adding or removing that may require some trade-offs on the compensation side. So there's nothing in the Dash 4 amendments that suggests that the local board has to impose this offer with the compensation package within that allowable growth factor. It allows them to use that. And we believe that creates a great deal of leverage and causes a more rational discussion of available school district resources and the amount of those resources that ought to be allocated to the salaries and benefits of existing employees versus, as I've tried to define, those program costs that enhance the educational opportunities for students. The copy of the testimony I provided, I think lays out pretty well a description of what the bill does. And on the back are some arguments about why we believe that this is a reasonable approach. We believe it does propose a balance between the need of school districts to enhance programs and provide, as well as control costs, while at the same time protecting the rights of employees to sit down with their employer and bargain. I like the term. It allows a safe harbor for school districts to avoid critical resources being diverted into collective bargaining that some suggest is a very time-consuming and expensive process if there's already an offer on the table that's believed to fit within that allowable growth factor. So we think it's an important cost containment measure and would be a very valuable tool in allowing school districts to enter into agreements based on some knowledge of future anticipated revenue to the school district, as well as some reasonable anticipation of what normal growth in overall compensation package ought to be. And there's nothing to prevent a school board from deciding to move compensation for employees around within that overall total compensation factor. They could maybe reduce salary on the one hand or hold salary at some level and increase the contribution for health insurance. There could be some early retirement arrangements. So there's a variety of options that this still allows school districts to have to construct a reasonable compensation package that recognizes the revenue that will most likely be available to the school district in the future. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Okay. Representative Monica Sanderson.
I need to understand the growth factor a little bit better. It seems like there's one growth factor that fits all. And some schools are going to be losing students. Others are going to be gaining students. Some school districts are in they're more affluent, and others are not. So how can you have a growth factor that fits all school districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monica Sanderson, to your one issue about the concern related to a growth or decline in students, on page 2 of the proposed Dash 4 amendment, starting at line 11, total compensation is specifically defined to not include compensation or costs associated with the growth or decline in the number of students. So if there is, in fact, a significant increase in the number of students and it became necessary to add staff, you could do that while still not affecting the allowable growth factor for compensation. And by the same token, if there was a decline in the number of students, then you wouldn't be forced to make a concomitant reduction. And I think the issue with declining enrollment is that students don't all leave in very convenient packages. That is, all the third graders don't show up next year, so you can eliminate the third grade. They leave all over the framework of the school district, and it's very difficult to reduce costs proportionate to that. So that's the reason for the specific exemption for the compensation based on growth or decline of students. And again, what we're proposing is a broad statewide average guideline that school districts may or may not use. If they decide for whatever reason to exceed the allowable growth factor, then they have to say why they did it and put that in writing and send it to a few folks. If they want to impose the growth factor for whatever reason, they're free to do that. It's a permissive approach that we think is reasonable, again, to cause the discussion of compensation to be in a framework of what actual anticipated revenue is going to be.
Paula?
Sure, Paula.
Right now we have the executive order, 15? And so we already have that growth factor. So this basically then makes them have to, the only difference between the executive order then and this bill is that the school districts are required to report to the Employment Relations Board.
Representative Monica Anderson, the executive order that's currently in place provides school districts with an estimate of revenue growth over a three-year period. This focuses strictly on an acceptable, allowable growth factor for compensation. Now, the amendments require that allowable growth factor for compensation fit within forecasted revenue. You obviously don't want to have a growth factor for compensation that exceeds the growth in anticipated revenue. So that again, we're on page 2 here, line 19, allowable growth factor shall reflect current economic, shall be within forecasted state revenues allocated for school districts and ESDs. So what we're looking at here is specifically a growth factor based on some estimate of reasonable growth in compensation, looking at a variety of issues, not just salaries, but also benefits and the broader range of those benefits.
Follow-up?
Follow-up. Yeah,
but that's already in the Executive Order 15.
The only thing in the Executive Order is a requirement that DAS produce an estimate of revenue that a school district can reasonably expect to receive over a three-year period. And it's a current service level approach. Given these estimated costs in growth in state revenue and the portion of the state budget allocated to schools and the increase in cost of schools, both on the personnel side as well as materials and supplies and personal services and so forth, what should a current service level budget for schools look like off into the future? This confines itself strictly to the compensation, employee compensation.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I'm trying to get a handle on costs and how we compare nationwide. Can you tell me how our salary numbers compare nationwide among the 50 states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I don't have that data in front of me. Based on the study that we completed, I would guess we're maybe within the top 10, 20 states in total compensation. And the study that we did, which I'd be pleased to provide you a copy with, indicated that our personnel costs were higher than many other states. I mean, our total compensation was higher, driven primarily by not necessarily salary, which, as I recall, we seem to be around average for teacher salary, for example, but that we had higher than average benefit costs. And I think that's driven by our retirement as well as health care benefits.
Well, follow up?
I researched at one point, it was 7th, that was the 99 session, 7th among the 50 states. Can you tell me how long a contract is in the state of Oregon and how that compares nationwide? How many days?
Representative Close, generally collective bargaining agreements, some are for 1 year, some go up to 3 years. I think probably the average is maybe 2 to 2.5. I'm not aware of any contracts that go longer than that, but I don't have the data in front of me.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I was referring to working days on the contract.
Oh.
How many days are contracted in the contract per year?
Representative Close, I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Would it be a 190-day contract?
Pardon?
190-day contract is what I've been told.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay.
And you don't know nationwide?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I know where to find out, and I'll find out.
Okay. Can you, do you have the numbers on the cost per child by state compared to Washington, California, Idaho?
Representative Close, again, we did a study of what we'll call a comprehensive analysis of K-12 spending in Oregon, and it was released last summer, and that date is there, but off the top of my head, I don't know.
I believe we're first among those states.
Okay, and can you tell me statewide, the figure I've been given is of the budget, statewide 85% of it is salaries and benefits. I know in my district it's been as high as 86. When I taught 25 years ago, it was 80% salaries and benefits. So what is the, again, I'm trying to think nationwide. Do you have any information nationwide what percentage across the nation is salaries and benefits of the school budget? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Yes. John, is this growth factor used in compensation for all administrators as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So that's a change. And what if you have, like, a change of administrator? One of the criticisms that I hear is where one administrator leaves and the next one comes in and they hire them at a much higher salary than the last one that left. So is that how does that fit in with the growth factor?
Can't answer that. I'll have to do a little bit more research. I'm sorry.
All right.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand this, the way in which the growth factor is calculated, and I think that's contained in Section 3 of these amendments. One of the issues that it talks about is to reflect to the current market conditions of the state, and within the forecast of state revenues allocated for school districts and education service districts. As I read the sentence, actually a couple more questions occur to me, so if I could, just a couple of questions. Now, would that sentence, if it were in effect now, lead to a reduction in the growth factor because market conditions in the state have declined in the last couple of years? And state revenues have declined in the last couple of years. Is that the import of that, or does it mean something else that I don't understand?
Representative Barnhart, I believe the intent of that current market condition language was to somehow reflect personnel costs, the competitive nature of school districts in attracting and retaining quality education personnel, and a variety of factors that may contribute to the cost of school districts in getting people to come into the education profession and stay there.
Okay, so it really is you're really after comparing costs in Oregon to costs in other places, and also costs for getting people to come into teaching as opposed to going into something else.
I believe, Representative Barnhart, that DAS could look at a variety of factors in calculating what they believed were these current market conditions, and that is costs that affect hiring and retaining personnel.
Okay. And that's the first part of the sentence. How about the second piece? Forecasted state revenues allocated for school districts. How would that affect this? You perceive that would affect this growth factor?
Representative Barnhart, I believe that would cause the DAS, and I would assume they would probably put together a working group of certified smart folks, would use what I would consider sort of a current service level approach. That is anticipated growth in revenue, anticipated growth of the K-12 appropriation, anticipated growth in local revenues, not only property taxes, but other local formula revenue, to try to get a handle on what the anticipated available resources to school districts might be in that over that five-year period.
Okay. This leads me to a different question on this. Within this area, is it anticipated that they would give an allowable growth factor for each, well, it does say for each of the next 5 years, so I don't presume that there at any one time there's one for next year one, next year two, and so forth on out. But you're thinking that this would include not only state revenues, but also local revenues.
That's correct.
So in the current situation, then, that we're in, if this were already in effect, presumably this would have a negative effect on the current forecast of state revenues, could have a negative effect, I presume, on these forecasts, and therefore on this allowable growth factor. I'll repeat a question somebody else asked earlier, and that is, could we then end up with a negative allowable growth factor based on these considerations?
Representative Barnhart, and I think it was Representative Close that asked, in a very unusual situation of deflation of some kind, mm-hmm. would it be possible for this allowable growth factor to be negative? Mm-hmm. And I believe yes. Mm-hmm. There are conditions that might exist. I think those are highly unlikely, and I'm not sure any of us want to be around to see them, but it could conceivably exist.
One more. And I don't know if you know the answer to this, and if you don't, just say that. Do you know where the language in, it looks like, page 2, line 14 through 22 came from? Is this in some sense a DAS proposal? Or the reason I ask the question, and this really ought to inform the answer, is that it contains, it's a very, very general statement of the bases for this, and I want to make sure somebody understands what it actually means.
Representative Barnhart, that's language that was worked on when this concept was originally proposed in 99, okay. and is the language that served as the basis for the governor's executive order that created the school revenue forecast.
Okay.
So I believe it is broad, with the hope that DAS can... Again, I'm assuming, and for the record I'll state, that if this bill passes and DAS has this responsibility, then they'll put together a work group of all the parties and certified smart folks and interpret what this means in as reasonable and rational way as possible.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions? Thank you for testimony. And that concludes the public testimony that had registered to testify, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3000, and colleagues will look to revisit this issue, I think, in the near future. Also, just as a scheduling matter, colleagues, we had a number of members throughout the chamber have at least expressed interest in attending the funeral of Representative Jensen's grandson on Thursday afternoon. And those of you who have that desire, I'd appreciate hearing that this afternoon so that we can determine whether we're going to have our regularly scheduled meeting Thursday afternoon. The alternatives are we can move some of the issues from Thursday onto Wednesday's schedule, or we can look at a potentially late Friday morning hearing. So anyway, just you can let us know after the meeting concludes. So without anything further for the committee, we are adjourned.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll be here.